All right, talking to my friend Nathan Schneider, who has a marvelous new book just out called Governable Spaces: Democratic Design for Online Life. I am tempted to begin by saying this is a fairly kind of low-key title for what turns out to be a wonderful ride in this book, sort of all over the place. It's probably going to surprise some readers the directions you go in. Any thoughts about the ride?
Yeah, I guess there's a set of ambition, kind of ambition there, not disclosed in the title. Embedded in the book is, a claim about what is at least contributing to the rise of authoritarianism around the world and how our kind of innocent everyday online communities are might be part of that. And then at the end, it gets into questions about whether the territorial nation state as a monopoly of citizenship has run into its limits. But all of that is the those are the kind of extreme reaches. A lot of the book is focused on really on the everyday, on what people experience in their ordinary lives, not the functioning of big companies or the policies of big governments, things like that. It really, the heart of it is in what we experience in our lives and our everyday spaces.
Yeah, I'm picking on this, picking up on this too. Everyday life, kind of rediscovery of, well, I guess it's the idea that the next big thing, you've probably heard this, crack, is a bunch of little things. So I think this is part of that. You know what you're also doing, wonderfully, I think, in the book is redefining a number of words. We have so many words that are in such great need of redefinition. And I thought I would begin by just maybe asking about a few. One that might seem a little weird to people is feudalism. And you're careful about that, but give us just a sense of what you mean by that, because that word is now in the air from several different corners, right?
I'm glad you bring it up. And actually, I really appreciate the chance to talk about feudalism with you in particular. We both have some of our roots in Catholic tradition, and feudalism is in some respects a kind of invented as a post-medieval insult to the Catholic dominated social order of certain periods in Europe. And lately it's been applied a lot. And in some respects, I wish I hadn't used this word. I'm not sure. But it also does resonate with a lot of people. It's often been used to talk about the power of tech companies lately. That's been a kind of common way of talking about it, and I think that's helpful in some respects. It's I think I've used it in that way and in previous work, but here what I'm really talking about is the kind of social order of our online spaces. This caricature, which feudalism always was, right? It was a kind of French invention in the kind of Enlightenment era, so-called Enlightenment era, looking back upon the world of guilds and lords and peasantry and the kind of medieval commons too, as
True.
imagining this world of total stability, of total domination and kind of authoritarianism among these local jurisdictions. And it's actually that cartoon that I'm trying to adopt and say is what we experience in, say, our Facebook groups and our group chats and our subreddits and these sorts of things, where the founders of a space end up having kind of total control over their domains to an almost cartoonish degree. And that kind of cartoonishness is reflected in the design of the online systems and in the norms and practices we've come to inhabit. So when I talk about implicit feudalism in this context, I'm not really talking about like the power of the companies yet. It gets there. But the implicit side too is the respect to which, and I use those words together, implicit feudalism, the respect to which we've been talking about online spaces and communities as fostering a new democracy. This goes back to the early kind of internet boosters of the 1990s, and this was diagnosed in the context of an essay called "The Californian Ideology" by
Yes.
Andy Cameron and
Yes, I
Richard
love this.
Barbaro.
I want to come back to that. Yeah, go ahead.
And they they talk about the way in which all these people are saying that democracy is going to come about through the internet, but if you actually look at what they're doing, it's much less democratic.
Yes.
And I'm arguing that that's been the case all along, that all this talk about democracy is very interesting and nice, but the same people who are talking about it, if you look at their practice, the way in which their spaces are being governed, it actually looks more like this cartoon feudalism. But I think it's also really important to honor the fact that, actual medieval political practice was actually had some very, very interesting designs.
Indeed.
And there's a lot to learn from from those kinds of forms of creative electoral processes and assemblies. And democracy did not go totally dormant between Athens and in the American Revolution. In fact, it was being explored and developed and experimented with in many different ways in Europe, as well as in many, many parts of the world, all over.
Indeed, indeed. Well, let's see, a second term you use. I guess I'm going chapter by chapter. This struck me a little bit. Homesteading. This also is a little bit of an ambiguous term. I sometimes thought of it as just simply meaning a home which was very sort of self-sustaining, kind of healthy, kind of Chestertonian sort of vibes. But there's another thing here. There's a colonial dimension, which is what I think you're pointing to as well. Say a bit about homesteading and what you mean by that, if you would.
Yeah, it also carries a kind of ambivalence. I really take the meaning of homesteading here from the Homestead Acts, which began during the Civil War in the 1860s under President Lincoln, and these were the laws that populated the American West with European colonists, basically inviting landless people to occupy land, to parcel it out, to erect fences and borders across land that was not previously understood as owned in that way. The movement of buffalo and of migratory indigenous communities depended on not having a kind of rigid fence everywhere.
Yes.
But the homestead was a particular political order that imposed those fences on that land. And in one respect, I think it's a very honorable task, and just in the sense that it was built on an assumption that to have a political democracy, you had to have an economic democracy. So in some respects, it was a way of opening ownership much more broadly across the population. When you compare that, for instance, to the kind of aristocratic parceling out of land in many parts of Spanish Latin America, right? And Iberian Latin America, this was a really stark departure that ordinary people could obtain, small amounts of land ownership, and that. That's something I'll stand for. But on the other hand, it was also, it was predicated on this assumption that this was land for the taking, which it was not. It was someone else's land. It was and it was a colonial process. So that distributed ownership really came at a cost, and we have to, recognize the way in which this language was also part of the early internet. It was often used alongside the language of frontier to talk about what people were doing in creating these online communities. And in a sense, what I'm doing is taking them at their word and saying that, yes, this is, what you did. You created these spaces with this imagination of a kind of conquest. And with that conquest, with that parceling of land, is that sense of local domination, right? The patriarch of the family now dominates that land, just as the admin of the Facebook group now dominates the space of that group. And so it really resonates with the practice of implicit feudalism, and conveys the sense in which this is not just an innocent practice of, how to set up, administrative configurations, but it's actually a political imagination that is being replicated in these spaces, and that actually feeds a kind of authoritarian impulse, in the same way that, there are tendencies of that old homesteading, colonialism that fed, for instance, the rise of, profoundly reactionary elements and in American culture, and these kind of fed into the practice of early online communities, as well as the kind of political imagination that these practices teach us.
You know, this theme of the recovering that's sort of everyday, I see it in a lot of places, and I notice also in the book, you in a couple of places touch on things of maintenance and repair and the theorizing around this. I wanted to mention this because I suspect you're already aware of it, but there was a book a few years ago called The Innovation Delusion. And that seems to have fostered a movement. It's maybe a mini movement, but I think it's growing, called the Maintainers. And there's been some wonderful writing from people around this group. And the effect of their writing is to really open up your imagination to the ways in which maintenance, repair, and care are all beginning to be, associated together rather strongly. And I really think it's almost a new kind of politics. You know, it has a flavor of localism, but you know, on the one side, there's the repair cafes that come out of kind of a technological impulse. But there's also, you know, there's the bridge down the street from me, which just collapsed, which was not really a repair matter, but it just shows the fragility of so much of our infrastructure and so on. But anyway, these themes are seem to be powerful, and they have the attraction of the immediate, you know, the sense that all of us in our own communities and our own families know that there is work of care that needs to be recognized. You are really wonderful on feminist economics and why that has to be a big part of this conversation. Maybe you could go a little further down this road with me.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. I'm part of I'm on the maintainers email list,
I
and
didn't. Oh, good. Okay.
the conversations that community's been having have really impacted me. Also, in our Center for Religion, Media, and Culture at CU Boulder, we've talked a lot about in recent years the concept of repair, particularly in post-colonial contexts, and so that language has been really has been really central for me. We recently did a pamphlet called Concepts Under Repair, where we explored, the reparation of concepts. But also it's a very material practice, as you suggest, really tied to care. And this kind of starts pointing toward some of the strategies I look to in the book for how to counteract this implicit feudalism and the homesteading that goes with it. Around, for instance, the concept of governable stacks, which is an invitation for communities to kind of take control of their own technology and their own relationship to technology, and to create relationships with their technologies and with each other that are based on the capacity for self-governance, and that involves care, that involves maintenance, that involves allowing yourself into questions that normally would be taken care of by somebody else for you, and And I reflect, for instance, on my participation in tech co-ops like May 1st Movement Technology, where we maintain servers and have to ask questions about how do we pay for those servers? How do we what kinds of tools do we use on them? When do we prioritize certain kinds of maintenance or adopting new technologies as opposed to sticking with older ones? These questions come up for us in a way that just never come up in the context of using Google Workplace in managing our Jitsi server, which is a video conferencing app. We've actually adapted it to be better suited for our bilingual meetings because the co-op spread operates both in the U.S. and Mexico, and we have had to make decisions about how to handle trade-offs of video quality and energy consumption, right? Because actually high quality crisp videos like you get on Zoom consume a lot of energy, and we've decided we're willing to sacrifice some of that video quality for lower energy costs, and that's that's the kind of choice that we can make when we make those stacks governable, when we allow ourselves to be part of that process of care. And the feminist economics, to me, is so central in being able to think outside of the logic of things as they are. This comes up in a bunch of different ways, but one of them is just in recognizing that work of care needs to be provisioned for and supported. This idea of feminist economics as a kind of attention to provisioning, to making sure that people's often invisibilized work of care and of governance is actually invested in. This is just a crucial concept for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let's see. Governable stacks is one of, I noticed, three new concepts that you introduce in the book. Let me go to the second one. What is modular politics?
So this is a design paradigm that I developed with the kind of co-founders, early participants in MetaGov, which is a research online research lab, anywhere between a few dozen and a few thousand people, depending on how you count. We started out with a paper trying to essentially imagine our way out of implicit feudalism. What would it look like to develop online systems that are built to support diverse and creative community governance, rather than to assume that there's one or a small number of admins running every space? How would we design our tools? And so we proposed a sequence of kind of design principles and outlined a few like potential case studies where, rather than, okay, opening up a new Facebook group or a new email list or group chat, and whoever opens it has all the power, can ban and censor and exile of people who misbehave, instead to say, okay, we're going to introduce a election module so that admin can be removed if people don't like them, or maybe there's juries that what would it look like to have a palette for creativity? And a couple examples of projects that have actually implemented this idea. One is Decidim, which is a platform that came out of Barcelona, when Barcelona had a very progressive government that was very interested in citizen participation. They supported the development of a platform to facilitate that, and now many cities use it. And if you look at the module list of the tools available that you can embed in that platform, it's just a wonderful menu of different possibilities for what civic participation can look like, from petitions to participatory budgeting to small group kind of reflection spaces. And so that's one example. Also, in the context of blockchains, there have been projects like Aragon, other platforms used to develop these online DAOs, these decentralized autonomous organizations. And these have also actually been rebuilt to adopt a kind of modular logic, with the idea that we should get away from this assumption that there is any one size fits all solution for governance, and instead create palettes where people can mix and match and build tools to fit their community's needs. And this is, I think, the kind of technical paradigm that you'd need once you recognize that, hey, the politics of everyday life actually maybe does matter.
Yeah, that also enables a kind of dynamism in governance rather than just some sort of a control, always a control mechanism. And you make the point that that dynamism, that kind of open-endedness, that Rosa Luxemburg approach is very important, very vital for this.
Well, to me, what has been some of the most thrilling experiences I've had in my career have been moments where I've seen people open up that question of how should we self-govern. That was the kind of thrill that motivated my, an earlier book of mine, Thank You, Anarchy, about the Occupy movement. What fascinated me was just like the play that people were engaged in around, okay, we have this space now, how do we self-govern it? And then like all kinds of ideas came out. And I saw similar things happen, when these blockchain started emerging and people had to, okay, now we have this new technology. We're not sure if it's useful for anything. Some of us are really excited about it, but now we have to figure out how to govern them. Or if you have a city like Barcelona saying, okay, we want some more citizen participation, then, an explosion of possibilities starts coming out. And it's those moments that I always find myself gravitating to, because they demonstrate that sense of democracy as a creative practice, not just as a set of institutions that you have to preserve. And this goes back to, this was something Alexis de Tocqueville recognized. He had this, when he was looking at early democracy in the United States, deeply imperfect and unfinished democracy, but nevertheless was able to recognize, oh, this is not going to work if it stays still. And this actually connected to his political theology, which was a recognition that no institution can capture, democracy truly. Democracy is as a kind of reflection of, divine human dignity. Democracy is the result of constantly trying to deepen and perfect our institutions' manifestation of that dignity, divine dignity. And if we're not pursuing, that and allowing ourselves to enter into that play, then it becomes static and stagnant. And I think that's where we find ourselves, in so many contexts today.
Very interesting. Democracy as a horizon, not as a place to arrive.
Right.
Yeah, that is
fascinating. Derrida talked about, democracy to come, always. Mm-hmm. Democracy is always this unfolding thing, not never a thing that we really have.
One of the things I love about your writing is that you mentioned, sort of governance as play. And in the book, up comes Johann Huizinga, Homo Ludens. Which I was not expecting, I think. But on the other hand, you also have a third category, governance archaeology. And in that archaeology is where we find, previous spirits like Huizinga that can help us find a way forward. Say a bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, I got introduced to that book, Homo Ludens, by a crypto developer. Who, for whom, because this new technology opened the challenge of how do we govern it, started turning to the past. And this governance archaeology work, which I started developing, particularly with the political scientist Federica Carigati, is very much built on that, on that challenge, that sense that the past, our ideas of the past shape our sense of possibility for the future. I the image in my mind for this project is the Jefferson Library in the Library
Yes,
of
I've
Congress.
actually seen that. It's down the street from me.
That's
Yes.
right. That's right. And it's this kind of funny spiral, and you look at it, and it's all these books about like ancient Greece
Yes.
And
Yes.
things like this, and it makes so clear that okay, he is building this new democracy with certain imagination of what of a past that is legitimating it, right? And of course the founders, Jefferson and others, were in tension with, for instance, the indigenous legacies that they were also drawing on but not giving credit to. You know, they did not see as legitimating. But we're nevertheless influencing them. And governance archaeology is an attempt to say, okay, we're confronting new governance challenges today in our world. How are we going to reconstitute our relationship to the past? If we do have, you know, modular politics, for instance, what do we fill those modules with?
Yeah.
And so what Federica and I have been doing, along with others, you know, a widening circle of collaborators, is trying to develop a kind of database and framework and practice of cataloging and making more available a wider range of governance legacies. So that involves, you know, pouring through books and trying to just collect thing, you know, and make accessible historical stuff that has already been documented. But it also means starting to develop conversations with, for instance, indigenous communities whose governance practices have often been suppressed and neglected, and try to develop a practice for understanding what is appropriate stewardship, and making sure that that relationship is not extractive, while also making sure that those legacies are part of the conversation to the extent that their stewards want them to be, for what the future of governing this world and this planet and our lives and our networks, you know, might look like. So governance archaeology, yeah, it's all about, you know, what do we, you know, how do we do better than Jefferson did? You know, then in making sure that we are that our imaginations are you know, are able to come alive and are able to honor the, you know, the building blocks and the inheritances that we're able to work with.
Yeah. You know, you unpack so many interesting people in the book, some of them familiar, some of them not. You know, Eleanor Ostrom's crusade against illusions of structurelessness was really fascinating to me. I hadn't quite thought about that. Your point that tech design is policy design, and you in the book talking a bit about policy in the bigger sense. Maybe we could touch on that also.
Yeah, I mean, in some respects, this builds on the old dictum of Lawrence Lessig, that's also kind of overstated often, of that code is law, right? And you know, to some degree, this is true. He never said code replaces law, but that it becomes an element, in the sense that every algorithm in a social media platform, for instance, is a kind of regulatory force. And I think this is just all the more the case in the context of systems like artificial intelligence, but, you know, I think most explicitly around things like blockchains, which are themselves kind of quasi-legal forces. They have contracts, they enforce contracts, they are, you know, monetary policy, all these things. And one thing that I've often noticed is that people in that context, culturally, are often opposed to things like bureaucracy and regulation and that sort of thing. They want a kind of free and open world. And I've been on a bit of a crusade to help the people designing these systems to recognize, no, you are doing policy making. You are building financial regulation into these protocols, just as the legal system is building financial regulation and law, and we need to be attentive to that because of this point so powerfully made by particularly the feminist theorist Joe Freeman in the early 70s of the tyranny of structurelessness. If we don't see what we are doing, when we don't see that we are regulating, when we imagine that we can inhabit a space free of regulation or of what she called democratic structuring, what you'll get is a kind of implicit tyranny. The people who have power already are going to be able to exploit that system to get even more power. She noticed this in small activist communities in the 1960s, but it's a pattern that many people have noticed in online life as well in the years since. So unless we are aware that when we are designing technical systems, we are doing policymaking, we're importing assumptions and legislating them, we're going to, carry out that same kind of false structurelessness and invite the kind of capture that has happened in every generation of, of internet technology.
Yeah, very good. You know, this book also goes pretty wide beyond, the interests that you and I often talk about, which have to do with cooperativism and those sorts of topics. And, I wonder if I could ask you in terms of sort of the what I would call the dark background of this moment and a couple of other books, I'd just love to get your reflections on vis-a-vis your own new book. One of them is Shoshana Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism, the big book of about 5 years ago. Does that still resonate with you? And do you think she was on to some of this, back when she put that book together?
Yeah, it's a book that I teach and that I've used and turned to over the years. I also have friends who were present in some of the conversations that she attempts to reflect there, who have insisted to me that her claims are not historical, and that we need to be really careful about leaning on them too heavily. But I do think there's something important in what she's saying about the way in which economic forces drove technology in certain directions. And actually, there's a new book that that I think really kind of fills the gap. That I'm really excited about. It's called Behind the Startup by Benjamin Shestakovsky, also published by University of California Press. It's the result of a careful participant observation in a tech startup in the gig economy. And he really painstakingly shows how venture capital drove decision-making. So I think this is in my mind kind of the successor. It's not as like kind of catastrophist as Zuboff is. I think she goes really overboard on some of these claims about kind of mind control. What I did appreciate about what she did is emphasize that role of economic decision making into technical decision making. This newer book, Behind the Startup, I think does that much better, and shows just how much these economic conditions matter. And so even though this new book of mine departs from my earlier work in that it doesn't start by focusing on company structure and political economy and things like that, it starts out with just like the texture of everyday life.
Yes.
It gets to them, right? And ultimately we come back to this point that, if venture capital is driving these platforms, we're never going to get these governable spaces. It's a contradiction. And so if we really want to be able to practice democracy in our everyday lives, actually, we do kind of need cooperative companies, or we do need democratic companies in some way. And so, so I found myself in some ways kind of disappointingly coming back to, the emphasis of my earlier work, which is still very much my current work, of saying, we can't really get away from this. Like, if we do want, democratic technology, we do need to figure out how to finance that in a way compatible with democracy, to build companies that are themselves democratic in some respect.
I did it since you came back full circle to thank you, Anarchy, in this book, right? Is that what you're thinking of here? The ideas.
Well, thinking of, first of all, my platform co-op book, platform co-op work, and the work I've done around cooperative tech companies for many years. But it is very much the case that, to me, this comes back to Occupy, because what I saw in 2011, in these uprisings in New York and around the world, was that the digital tools were really good at getting messages out. But what they were really, really inadequate for was the structure. They did not enable people to build durable movements. That's why the Facebook supported the nice liberals of Egypt, who wanted to drive Mubarak out and replace it with a constitutional democracy. What ended up happening was the Muslim Brotherhood took over, because they were organized offline, because they had a real political party. And the same thing happened with many of the Occupy movements. An exception was the Spanish, because they went back to the neighborhoods, and they organized at the neighborhood level. But those who were relying too heavily on digital tools, ended up having nothing left once the physical occupations were gone. There was no way to make decisions, to govern, to shift tactics, to retain structures, to accumulate power and resources. And so, to me, in some respects, this book is an attempt to answer that question, to say, it is built into these tools to keep people unable to really build democratic organizations. And if we want to have democratic movements in the age of social media, we have to have, we have to build that into the structure of our technologies, or the organizations that control those technologies. So it does, in that respect, come back to, to 2011.
Wonderful. Wonderful work. Thank you so much for the book. Thank you for checking in with me today. Nathan Schneider, pick up a copy of Governable Spaces, Democratic Design for Online Life. It is free on Kindle if you want to go that route.
Or
Thank you.
from University of California Press, if you don't use a Kindle,
And if you don't use a Kindle.
it's available in many formats, open access for everyone. Thanks
Wonderful
so
work.
much, Elias.
Thank you.